Have you been on a podcast before, Chloe?
Yes, I have.
And how was it?
That was weird because it was over the phone. And it was the first one and I was very self-conscious. Oh. It went well, but I was really shaky. You know, when I hung up, I was like, oh my God, this has just happened.
Well, second time's the charm, maybe.
Maybe. We'll see that after we're finished.
Okay. Welcome to Wombat Radio. Today we're talking with Chloe Fournier. Hi, Chloe.
Hi, Matt.
Do you want to start maybe just setting the scene of what you do or what you're interested in or what you're busy with?
So I am a French-Australian dancer, choreographer, performer, actor, all these things. I work independently or with companies, and at the moment I'm trying to develop my choreographic practice as a solo artist and ultimately with also group, because I really want to remove myself from performance and just choreograph on people. And what I make, I'd say, is dance theatre, because I'm really interested in crossing art forms and collaborating with other people, such as designers, you know, dramaturgs, musicians, whoever, really, depending on... it depends on, you know, what I'm after at a certain point.
How wide have you gone with who you've collaborated with? Like, have you collaborated with a rocket scientist or...?
Not yet. I'm actually really interested in science, in cognitive science, so I would like to go there at some point, but I feel like I need to research more myself just to be able to understand all the relationship between the body and the mind, because it's very complex. But I'd like to work with scientists or neuroscience, especially, and psychology. I really like psychology. And I think it's really great actually to look at psychology, especially in a way how artists communicate their ideas to the audience, and you know how you can play a little bit with the mind, in a sense. It's very manipulative. It's bad.
But, I mean, crafting, manipulation, they can be a similar thing. Like, you're manipulating choreography or you're crafting choreography, and are you doing it to work on the choreography, or are you using choreography to work on the audience or on the viewer? Tell me more about cognitive science and neuroscience and the relationship with that and choreography and your practice.
So I made a 12-minute solo work on Imogen Cranner, I think it was 2 years ago or so. And that's when I really started to look at the brain and how, as human beings, it's almost impossible to disconnect from, you know, our thoughts process. And sometimes I feel like the body gets stuck because we get into our brain too much and we start thinking and judging ourselves, and then we move a very different way. So I thought, how can I release the mind and just have the body just going crazy without thinking about what we're doing, really? So that's how we worked. And we worked also on the idea of brain damage or disease of the brain and how it could influence the body choreographically. There's this great example that I give is the alien hand syndrome, which is the left part of the body basically has a mind of its own, and you can't quite control the left side of your body until you look at the body part and you say stop. And it's an actual disease, but I find that fascinating. And the idea was like, how can I do this on a dancer's body and make them continue and split the body in half, which is actually really hard when you do it consciously, because we do it all the time, but when you start thinking about it, you become unable to do it.
It's like when you're supposed to clap out of time or dance off the beat or something.
It's actually, and suddenly you get, oh my God, how do I do this?
And what are your thoughts about that as a viewer? Like, if I'm the viewer and I'm watching somebody doing this half body split, what are you hoping that that's doing to me?
I think visually it creates a bit of panic somehow. It's about the intensity of the movement and a bit of the wow factor, I know it's silly to say that, but it doesn't happen that often in contemporary dance unless it's highly technical and we're doing all these splits and these things. And I think there's another type of virtuosity, which is in, you know, the speed or the actually the liberation of the body, doing something that is not as controlled, but still is in a sense because it's choreographed, but there is a liberty within the choreography. So I think as an audience, I can always see when the dancer is really into what they're doing and let go of this brain of theirs instead of just doing the steps that I've been, you know, taught, which is also interesting, but that's not what I like making, I guess.
Yeah, or seeing maybe.
Yeah.
What do you like seeing? Like when it's not your shows, when you go and see a show, what is it that really does it for you to view?
I like seeing raw movement. Ah. For example, Hofisch Schaefter. I just love it because they all have the same choreography, but all the dancers are doing it differently to their own personality. So I like seeing the personality of the dancer while seeing the personality of the choreographer.
Mm.
I think it's a mix of both. And especially these days, the choreographers often don't choreograph as much.
Mm.
They give tasks.
Yeah.
And I like seeing this collaboration on the dancer's body, I guess.
Mm. Are there other people that kind of nail it for you like that?
Oh, I'm sure there is. Actually, I'm really influenced by visual arts. And I just came back from a trip to Europe and seeing the art of Dali, for example. Like, surrealism is my favorite art movement. I am really inspired by it. And the way Dali saw especially the female body, is quite amazing. And all the shapes, it's very fluid, but there's this mystery. And how respectful of the woman he is as well. It's just very interesting. It doesn't treat it as an object, but as this very mysterious animal, almost like a weird species that he's unable to understand, but yet he does when he paints it or when he sculpts it. Especially his sculptures are beautiful. So, yeah, painters. I really like painters.
And surrealism.
And surrealism.
And do you get surreal when you make work?
I think, in a sense, yeah, because I play with metaphors.
Yeah.
So I think metaphors are surrealism in a sense. Mm. So for this last work, Dining Unstable, I used a few metaphors or references, analogies, and I continue to use this in my work because that's what really interests me. I guess Kate McIntosh is someone that I really love. I really like her work and I like her process. So, yeah, it's also a way for me to develop my practice, getting inspired by these artists. And definitely I would like to make a work that is more surrealist than what I normally make, but I'm not there yet.
No. Do you have a vision of what that would look like, your surrealist spectacular?
Yes, I think, I don't know, I've got this idea of having five dancers.
Yes.
There's something about number five.
Yes.
I like odd numbers a
yes,
lot.
Yes, definitely.
five dancers. For some reason, I just see women. I don't know why. But with a very high sense of the male presence as well, but without having any male on stage. Don't know why. And then I think it would be really crazy. And maybe there would be paint, because surrealism is such a big painting, you know, current, and film obviously, because surrealism, you know, through film. I think it would be a big multidisciplinary performance, probably site specific, large scale, if I had like a massive budget. Let's go crazy.
Yeah, let's go crazy. And do you think that would be fertile ground for cognitive science and psychology and surrealism all bubbling together, or do you see those as different?
No, I think I always use the cognitive science in the background, even if I don't say in the program notes, or even I just get inspired by it. I read about it, and then I think it's when I make the movement or when I ask for a task, even if I don't say that to the dancer, in the back of my mind, I know it's there because I've studied it and I know exactly why I'm asking this. It's just to see the response to it.
Yeah.
But I don't like giving too much indication either, because otherwise they start thinking too much about it.
Yeah.
And I want them to make their own choices without me influencing them too much.
And And it's also about framing what is just the tool that you're using to get to the thing.
Yes.
And sometimes people get caught up on the tools and that's all that they think the work is about.
So I think it's just a, yeah, it's just a tool, but then you have to move away from the tool and respond from, I mean, I prepare what I make, but you always have to be open to whatever's going to happen like in the moment.
In hecklers the in the crowd or something.
Yeah.
Have you ever had a heckler?
A what?
Sorry. Like somebody in the crowd that yells shit out during the show? It happens all the time with stand-up comedians.
I haven't had that, but when I did Dining and Stable, it was very funny. It was for the opening night. Opening night is always a weird night, isn't it?
Mm.
And because it was a participation piece, I had a family with me, and especially a brother, a dad, and a mother, and myself, actually, four people that were really main characters, and the rest were other family members. And at some point, the person being the dad, even though I ask questions or I talk to him, he has the choice to respond or not. And I had both situations, which were both a bit awkward in a sense.
Yeah.
But I had someone asking all these questions that were not related to the work at all and just making references to Koh Lanta, you've been voted out of the island, when I asked him to just go. And it was very funny. But I had to, you know, keep at it, keep in what I had built and where I wanted to go as well, while still responding and not ignoring what was happening. So it was not a big like boo or shit, but it was like, all right, how am I going to deal with this now? But I love it because
so how did you deal with it? How did you stay on track while also being responsive?
Because I was prepared for it, and I always have improvisation within the work. And I knew they would, some of them would take the offer, especially if they've been performers. I was trying to avoid, because you can always tell when someone is a performer.
Yeah, or if they've been drinking before the show.
As well.
Like a 9 o'clock show is a lot more rowdy than a 7 o'clock show.
But I think it was challenging, but it gave another substance to the work. And it was a way, I think, for this person to deal with what was happening to him at that point.
Right.
As well, because his position was not an easy one. And it was a way of releasing. That's how I was thinking of it in the moment. I was like, it's all good. And because I come in and out of the performance mode within that piece as well, was not that it was easy to deal with, but it was okay to do so. It didn't look awkward or anything. Well, for me, at least, maybe. the audience thought, oh, my God, what's happening there?
I had a question about the rest of your season of Dining Unstable and how it turned out and if...
Yeah, so it was... Dining Unstable has been a long process.
How long?
So the first time I presented a development of it, was not the show, was at the Adelaide Fringe in 2012.
When did you have the idea before that?
The idea started with an audition I did with Meryl Tankard, where she actually asked at some point to do a 2-minute choreography, including text, about a relationship in our life. So I started to, you know, play with it in my own relationship with my father. So I did this 2-minute thing, and then I was like, oh, there's something very interesting in this. And I developed it into an 8-minute solo and then into a 12-minute solo work. And then it was Dean Walsh who came to see the show and said, oh, you should develop it further.
Mm-hmm.
I would have never thought I would made it a hour show at all. But it kept on developing. And then in 2014, I had a 40-minute piece, I think. But it was still... How can I put it? It was a bit of anger within the work that was not necessary. So I was like, oh, how am I going to deal with this? So I asked for the performance at PACT for Michael Piggott to be the dramaturg for the piece. And he's a theatre-based artist. And I'm really interested in the theatre dramaturgy, but in dance. Because I think there's dance dramaturgy and there's theatre dramaturgy, and I believe they're very different.
Yeah.
And because there's a lot of text, and actually Dining Unstable may be more of a theatre piece. I don't like putting little etiquettes on work.
Yeah.
I think it's just a performance work and whatever, isn't
it's
it?
It's a live.
Yeah, it's live performance, and there's no need to say what it is, really. Just watch it and like it or hate it, you know? I think it helped me find this very fine line you know, shifting from the emotions, but never, I don't know how to explain it very well. So, such a personal feeling, but just find the thing that was going to make the audience relate to it better.
Yes.
Without seeing it, like they could see it as my story or their story or someone else's story. So I had to remove myself a little bit more and make it just a story and less about me, I guess. You know, opening up and finding, pushing certain ideas further that were not necessarily the reality. Because a lot of people ask me, oh, is it true? Is it not true? And then, who cares?
Yeah.
It's a piece of work. And if I tell you everything about it,
yeah.
It's not interesting anymore.
It's like explaining a joke.
Exactly. I'm really bad at getting jokes.
So you ask people to explain them to you?
No, I just said to them, the chances are I'm not going to laugh at it, but don't take it personally. It's just, I don't find jokes funny most of the time.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your experience with dance dramaturgy versus theatre dramaturgy?
Yeah. I feel my...
And what's useful to you?
I got to question why people go to a theatre, like to a play, more than they would go to a dance show.
Yes.
And I think it's because dance sometimes is so abstract or so intellectual that people don't find satisfaction, maybe, and they don't get it. And I truly believe that you don't have to get something to like it, but this is not a majority of people. So I was just wondering why. And I thought, I did this amazing, I was working with Catherine Puey on this show. She's got Shudder and Boyana Kunst. I can't pronounce her name. Kunst came to be the dramaturg on the show. And I was like, wow, this is amazing what dramaturgy does for, you know, for the questioning.
Good dramaturgy.
Yeah, good dramaturgy. But I think there's just, dramaturgy is very hard to find.
Yes.
And
because maybe it relies on somebody that is literate enough in the form that you're working in and broadly aware and informed enough to be able to put it in context so that they can ask you, the creator, the right questions rather than stepping in and giving you little like single serve justifications for the shit that you want to do anyway.
And because mentoring is different, because I've had been mentored, but mentoring is a bit more, I don't want to say forceful, but it's
leading.
Yeah, it's a bit more, yeah, you're right, leading. Rather than dramaturg, he really listens to you and he's not trying to impose an idea on you, but trying to, for you to find your idea, really.
Yes.
And what was great with Michael is that I've seen his shows before, I've seen the shows he's directed, and there's a real sense of physicality. And I was like, he's perfect because he's going to get the physicality. He's going to help me to see how I can convey a meaning of some words, but instead of the words, it's going to be movement, finding the theatricality within the dance, I guess. And I think I wanted to work, I still want to work with dramaturgy because deep down I'd like to be a dramaturg myself, I guess. So self-centered. again, I don't know enough. Yeah. And it was wonderful to be working with someone who knew what he was doing and asked me the right questions. Like from the start, he said, okay, where are you in this moment? What are you thinking? What are you doing? What is the relevance of the others around you? So it was like really thinking about the audience as well. Which is always hard, especially when you do a solo work. When you do a solo work, you really need an outside eye. You need people to come and tell you, I don't get this at all. Like here, you're in your own world and you don't, you know, you don't give me anything.
Yeah. And even if I'm pretty happy if someone doesn't get it, but they feel it, then I'm pretty happy to let it sit there. But yeah, if they don't get it and they don't feel it, then they don't need to come.
Mm.
I can just do it for myself.
Yeah, it's so true. I had someone who came to see the show and said to me, I didn't get everything of what you did, but she said to me, I was just so moved that it didn't matter.
Mm.
And it's someone that is not an artist at all. And for me, that was the best comment I could have gotten, because it was someone who doesn't normally go to see a dance show and probably will try to go to see another dance show because they had a good experience. Mm. So, yeah.
How do you deal with, like, considering that you did something that moved that viewer, do you consider, like, the emotional state of your viewers, or do you just consider the emotional state of your performance or your performers and then hope that that translates? How do you deal with emotion?
For this work, I worked with both, and I think I always work with both, like the emotion of the audience and my own emotions.
Mm.
For this one, because it started from a personal state as well, I really had to work hard to at some point put my emotions away and just use them when it was needed in the work.
Yep.
Otherwise, it becomes a personal, you know, a bit of a psychotherapy on stage. So it was a big no-no. But then there were moments, especially when I use the figure of the mother, and I'm really strong about what I tell her to do. And I say it was quite mean what I was saying to her. But I was playing with her being the mother, knowing that people... everyone around needed to feel that it was really my mother on stage, while knowing there was a random person. So still, you know,
taking care. Yes,
you always have to take care of your audience. But because I got her to a certain point that she trusted me, I explained to her what was going to happen, more or less. So, yeah. And I said, "Are you okay?" And she was like, "Yeah, no problem." So I knew I could push it, but to a point that I had one of the mums, I could see their eyes being teary.
Oh no,
it is hard to take. But I was like, that's how she's coping with this moment right now, and she's okay. But at the end of the show, I do go to these people who have helped me and I make sure that everything is fine, because that was also part of the... there was a difficulty, like me really being careful that I was not too pushy on them. Even for the dad, especially during the end, I had some of the men. It was so beautiful because they became so fragile, and it's not a position that we see men in very often. And they were like, I don't know what to do. And they were talking to me at a point where I didn't expect them to talk. But it was also a way of coping and being like, what do you want me to do? And I could see their eyes again being teary. So, yeah, it was quite satisfying to see this happening.
Did you have to... how did you get them to a point of vulnerability?
I hate that word, but I'm going to use it. I think that was a real journey. Oh, God.
You crafted a journey.
Yeah. I had to make them part of the family.
Your imaginary family.
My imaginary family. But, you know, when I was on stage, it was my family. It had to be, otherwise it wouldn't have worked. But I also had to play with them and how they were reacting. Because everyone has their own personalities, so every night was a different show.
Yeah.
Because there were very different dynamics that they had to balance out. And at the beginning of the show, I also choose who's going to be who.
Do you choose when they're in the foyer, or you choose when they're sitting down?
No, in the foyer, I come, say hello to some people, look how they interact with other people. And sometimes, I don't know, it sounds a bit silly, but there's this energy. People have energy. And I was like, oh, I've got a good feeling with you. Oh, you look a bit more... And with the dads, there's... don't want to say tell the whole show, but there's like three dads during the show. And the men, it's the hardest. First, because there's less of them coming to the show, so I had to be very careful who I choose. And there was also the brother. So I was like, okay, you're going to be dad number one because you look more like what the dad is at that point in the piece, and you're going to be number two because at that point I need someone a bit stronger, or a bit darker, a bit more mysterious, someone, you know, a bit austere, I think. And the third one is very funny because I think there was almost two ends to the show. Whether I asked someone a bit older to come to the stage and would really be this meeting with the dad again. And then two nights actually, it was someone a bit younger that could have been my boyfriend, really. And I felt like, oh, the end can be taken both ways. And it's so, for me, it was very interesting. And I think some of the audience as well, because they were like, oh, it's not quite... some people were like, it's not quite finished, is it? And I was like, it's a relationship. It can never be finished. It's life. Life only finishes when you're dead. So, and it was this idea that I wanted it to them to question, so who is that last man? Who can he be? Because I think the relationship you have with your parents or during your childhood truly influences who you are as an adult. And again, it's this psychology research that I've been doing about father and daughter relationships, which is a very complex one that is not really talked about. We talk a lot about the mother and son relationship or mother-daughter, and we think that...
Was that just because of Freud? Freud set the standard for the relationships that we talk about.
I did read a lot of Freud. Actually, the whole idea also for this work was reading Kafka.
Yeah.
Letter to My Father. And it's a wonderful book. It's a letter that he wrote and never gave to his dad. So I read it over and over to try to identify how he felt. And it's funny how, not that it was exactly the same relationship, but there was this fear, but this wish for something better as well. And I used some of the emotions within that letter to put into the work, and some, a lot of, you know, talking to other people and how they relate to their family. And
so it starts with you and your actual story or influences or whatever, and then it just has to become a show, and it has to get filled in with all of these other more theatrical or dramatic or universal.
Universal. It has to become universal, because some people don't necessarily have, you know, problems with any of their family. Still, there's the family dynamic. It's a family dinner. You come to the show, you come to a party, you come, it's not a stage anymore. Especially at PACT, there's no stage, so it's just a space, and it was great.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, if I had had a massive budget, I think I would have put the audience more in couches, more like a big picnic type thing. Well, that was impossible, but still there was this thing about we're at home, we're not
at the theatre. Okay, so changing a little bit focus, I want to ask you about what it's like to work across New York to Sydney to Paris in all these different contexts. Like, do you feel like you're one of those international choreographers or artists, or do you feel like actually you've just been to those places and made friends and you just do what you do wherever you end up?
It's really hard when you leave your home country. It's almost like you have no home anymore, or your home is everywhere. So I guess after, you know, I think I've been here for 8 or 9 years, so home is more Sydney than France. And I actually love Sydney because people say it's really hard to be an artist in Australia, in Sydney. But there's a challenge there to make things change.
Yeah.
In Europe, well, in France especially, it's very different. The way we see arts is part of life. It's not something that we do outside of life. You know what I mean? Like, the arts is, it's a government thing, and whenever these other sponsors coming in, people are just like, no, it's corrupted and la la la. Like, it's really weird. And it's kind of the only format almost in the world, I think. But then as an artist, you also have to be, you're so inspired by everything around you that, you know, if you're in Africa and you want to make a dance piece, well, why not making it, you know, in Africa or in wherever you are?
Yes.
I think you have to be, as whatever type of artist you are, you need to be inspired by everything and see possibilities for inspiration everywhere. Just walking in a park, just listening to music, just everyday life somehow.
What is that? Can you tell me what it feels like to be inspired by something, to see something and...
I get really passionate. I have all these ideas in my mind, and sometimes I just go, oh, I'm crazy, because half of these things that I've got in my head are never going to happen. But there are some ideas that stick and they keep on coming back, and that's when they happen.
Yeah.
Like at the moment, I think I'm working on, in my head, in like 3 other works. There's one that is in development, so it will happen, but it's not quite there yet. And I think it takes, for me, it takes a very long time to to get something on the stage because I need to do so much research, and because I'm really interested in sociology as well and human behaviors. And I'm looking at something that is more relevant for society, but at large, not just for artists or not just for one group. So it takes me, yeah, a super long time. But I keep on getting inspired. I love, for example, music videos. Every time I watch a music video, I go like, oh my God, this is so cool. How can I just use some of these ideas, but differently? And also with inspiration, I read something one day, because I always had this problem, oh, some people are just painting ideas from other artists and I can clearly see that they've stolen it in a way. Bad word. And I read this quote was saying, inspiration, be inspired by an artist, know everything there is to know about this artist, and then when you make your work, make it better. So you can still grab things from other people, but making better or differently.
Stealing is justified if you're progressing it.
Exactly. And I think it's quite true, because these days everything has been done. It's almost on stage for debt. You know what I mean? An arabesque will always be an arabesque, you know, or like people were trying to do something very conceptual, and then you just go back to Germany 20 years ago and they've done that already. It's really hard to do something completely new. But why not using ideas that have already been looked at?
But the context changes. So you can do the same thing and it means different and it affects differently. What do you think is then the frontier of, like, how do you push and develop and progress something that is supposed to be contemporary and adaptive and responsive?
I think we need a new word for contemporary, because we've been using that word for so long that nothing is really contemporary anymore.
So there was modern, and then there was postmodern, and then there was contemporary.
Yeah, contemporary dancer. Like, it's always when people ask me, so you're contemporary dancer, what do you do? I just kind of do the weird shit because otherwise it doesn't.
You wanted to call it surreal dance.
Maybe it's a nice word. I don't know. I can't even tell, because some people, you know, say interpretive dance or... Yeah, I don't... How do you push? I think you push by the... Technology is something that is really pushing the arts, but you have to be careful. Sometimes you go to a show and it becomes a technology show instead of a dance show or a theatre show. I've been to some theatre shows that were just like, all right, if I had stayed at home and watched a screen, it would have been the same almost. And it's so distracting. We're so used to look at screen that somehow, even if we have both on stage... you start to just look at the screen.
Definitely.
So when you make your show, you have to be careful of that balance as well. But I think ultimately, you know, how cool would that be to have like a 3D dancer on stage? I've thought about this. It will happen.
Robots or holograms?
No, and holograms. I'm sure someone is doing it.
There's bands that have performed in 3D.
Yeah.
And dead singers been re-performed. Tupac performed in 3D.
Yeah,
probably against his wishes, but
They actually say that, like with Facebook and all these things now, when people are gonna die, they're gonna compile all these photos and create a little avatar that you can still
interact
to them.
Yeah, there's you heard of a TV series called Black Mirror?
No, I haven't.
So each episode, it takes an idea like that and it just plays it out to see what the world would be like.
Wow.
Jumps forward about 20 or 30 years. Mm-hmm. And there is an episode like that. A girl and her fiancé are in a car crash and he dies. She starts chatting to him online in text. And then because of all the videos that they uploaded through his life, this company can recreate his voice so she can talk to him over the phone. And then eventually there's an Android replacement that she can get. And it's like, it's him, but it's...
It's not.
Not him. Yeah. It's pretty radical.
I found that really weird. I had to look at that because this new development I'm doing is about grieving and death and all these things and looking at the place of technology within this.
Mm.
And, there's something that... I hope I'll be dead by that time that no one will have my hologram.
I'm excited, if we're talking about tech, I'm excited not about the small iterations and tweaks that happen to the theatre, because I think that's been happening for a long time from sound systems to lights that are LED, where they used to be incandescent, where they used to be actual limelight, where they used to be candles. Mm. But then what happens when we become space going and people have 3 or 4 months between Earth and Mars and they don't want to watch screens and they want to see a live performance, and you become a cruise ship dancer, but on the Earth to Mars cruise ship, the zero gravity cruise ship, you know, or the like less gravity,
yeah.
And then what choreographic possibilities that has.
Mm.
That would be cool.
That would be, yeah, it would be floating. New challenges.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you, the film clips that you're talking about, are there any specific film clips?
I think there is plenty. There is this French artist called Loudoyon, and her videos are like short films, really.
Oh, yeah.
And but still, it is a video clip, and it's amazing. Then there's another French artist who's called the French Madonna. She's called Mylène Farmer, and every time she actually makes a video clip, it is a film. Some of her video clips are 20 minutes long, and sometimes she makes one song and then the second song is the continuation of the song before.
Mm.
But there's a lot of beauty in it, and there's softness about it. It's just really aesthetic.
Mm.
And I like that, the purity. And then I like the ones that are a bit more trashy. And you just go, oh, this is disgraceful. But I think it also, you learn a lot from these things on what to do or where society is at.
Yes.
As well. And I just go, wow, how can you go from a video clip that is so beautiful and makes you feel like sad and something weird inside you, and then you watch another video clip, you know, that is a bit more maybe R&B or whatever. It's just like all these bikinis and these, you know, bums on the screen, and you just go, wow, this makes me feel weird as well, but in a very different way. But still, there's some research in the way that, you know, the speed, the editing, that there's always something, everything. I always think there's something good in everything bad. So
even if it's only the inspiration for you to not do it that way.
Yes, I think it's a good thing. Or to use it and show how wrong it is.
Mm.
Oh, there's this video clip that I love, actually. I can't remember the name of the band, but I'm sure everybody knows about that song. It's a South African band. I think you're freaky, but I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I love this video clip. Oh, yeah,
I think like you're freaky, but I like it a lot.
That's it.
Or like you a lot. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
what happens in the clip?
Oh, it's in black and white,
yeah.
And they all look so weird and really alien zombie-like.
Yeah.
But there's this, it's, I don't know, it's uncomfortable, but you just want to watch it over and over again. And the song is not even that great, but it's, but I love it, you know. I don't know. I can't understand why. It's really catchy.
There's Express Yourself by Diplo, and it is, in some ways, it's your classic, like, rap and DJ and someone yelling into the camera and then girls shaking bums. But they've taken it so extreme that it becomes some kind of virtuosic movement practice or something. And the way that the flesh responds to that kind of movement, it just leaves you in awe and mystery somehow. Like, they've transcended the trashiness.
Yeah.
Everything is the aesthetic of trash, but because it's gone so far, it's become, yeah, something special or something unique or something that you can't believe.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just booty shaking. It ends up into, like, boys and girls having booty shake battles and then, like, girls doing booty shaking and handstands. And then, yeah, like, and they're not doing it in front of flash cars or anything. It's, like, a really shitty rundown corner store or something.
Yeah. I think some artists probably also take the piss out of this culture. No, but you know what I mean? I think they push it also because they think it's a bit wrong.
I'd like to take the piss out of the... like one dude strumming a guitar in an old car driving along next to a beach or something video clip. I'd really like to do one of those. And I don't know how you would take the piss. I guess you would do a different song, or you would just have people in the car that were not white as well, or something like that. But just take that, what is like such a known form. My cousin actually got cable TV when he moved out of home specifically for the Country Music Channel. Just loved that bit of it so much because he had moved to the city from the country.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah. So maybe you could like not take the piss, but completely get into the zone of wearing the buckle and the jeans and the boots and looking down at your feet as you kick scuff up some dirt in like the sunrise morning.
Yeah.
Something yeah. like that. And then subvert it or subvert the message, or I don't know, it would be interesting.
I think there's a lot you can do with music videos.
Yeah.
One of the...
So why are you in theatre then and not in music videos?
I think I just really started... I've always liked music. When I was young, I was really like music. Not so much the music videos, but I knew every band that was coming out and everything. And then I moved to Australia and there was a new scene for me and I wanted to concentrate on my dance practice. You know, I was just arrived and it's actually really hard to start from scratch.
But then you're also not listening to music in French anymore. You're listening to it in
No,
English.
It's okay because I've always listened to, international artists, but it's true we don't have that many Australian, like emerging Australian artists, but we don't hear them back in Europe.
What about Missy Higgins?
Yeah, a little bit, yeah, but I'd say I'm more interested in the ones that we don't really know about.
Yeah, right.
The ones that are not that famous.
Yeah.
Because I think they make, same as the dancing, it's a bit raw.
Yes.
And I like that, and they're still a bit vulnerable and really do what they want to do.
Yeah, and they're still working it out. Like somehow you can be there with them working it out.
And I remember actually Clat Control.
Yeah.
When this started out, and I really loved that band. I was like, wow, it's so much better than all the other crap that there isn't, you know. And then people become famous and there's something that is not as pure or raw or wrong or imperfect. I like imperfections.
Yeah, I think I like the reach. I like seeing that people are reaching towards something and that they've maybe stumbled upon, they've come upon the edge of themselves in through their practice. And so it's quite a special thing. And there are some performers that I think can make you believe that every night that you see them.
I think it happens with theatre and it happens with dance as well. Once you more... When it gets a bit easier for you, it's almost like there's certain laziness. And, sometimes you can see it. Not everyone, but sometimes you can. And it happens with music. I think it happens with every art form.
Would you say music is your biggest influence? Or reading science is your biggest influence, or sociology and construct?
No. I'd say people around me is the biggest influence.
Yeah.
I really observe people around or things that happen through life. It's not that I want to talk about myself when I make a work, but it's a bit like, you know, when someone writes a novel and some people say, oh, you know, it's all fiction. And I think in every fiction, there's a part of yourself. And I think it's the same when you create any type of art. You use some of your own experiences.
Yeah.
Because that's what you know.
Speak language.
So I'd say influence, it depends. I change my mind very quickly as well.
Yeah.
So if I go and see an exhibition, I'm going to be so inspired and have all these new ideas and go, oh, I could make this, I could make that. I could, you know, when I was in Europe, for example, visiting all these galleries or meeting people from different art centres. It's like, oh, what can I bring back to Australia?
Yeah.
I think
Do you ever think when you're in Australia and you're about to go to Europe, do you ever think, oh, what can I take to Europe that they really need, that they haven't thought of yet?
I think... I don't know what Europe is a very interesting, it's changed so much over the years. I don't know what they need right now.
They don't need anything from us. Is
I think Europe is a bit lost at the moment. It's
in a like its identity or
yes, and with the you know the financial crisis and now the whole immigration crisis as well. It's very hard for them. It's almost like they've lost their sense of priorities or. And I don't know. I think artists over there, it's very hard for them as well. A lot of companies have disappeared. You know, when we say it's hard in Australia, it's hard everywhere. Stop kidding yourself. But what I think about Australia, though, is that we've got something. Australia needs to take risks more. That's yes. The main thing. And also acknowledge the history, because they do have an history.
Yes.
Like all the indigenous history that doesn't seem to be taken into account, but it is, you know, the history of Australia. And it's a shame that I think this needs to go to Europe more, especially Paris. You know, I went to the Museum Care Bromley, which specializes in indigenous cultures from all over the world. And I discovered so much about, you know, South America that I didn't know, that we're so not in tune with this. That's a bit sad. I don't know if I go to France wanting to bring something there. I think it's really weird because I don't feel so French, but I don't. Obviously, I'm not. I mean, I'm Australian, but I became Australian. You know what I mean? With the national, like.
You became Australian after your self-identity was already emerged rather than just by being born.
Yeah, I wasn't born in Australia. So I think some people don't understand that sometimes you don't have to be born somewhere to feel like.
You are of there.
You are part of it somehow because my culture has changed and the way I behave has changed because France and Australia is like completely different.
Yeah, I know.
France is so uptight sometimes, you know, and so proper and you have to do this a certain way and that and Australia's a bit more chilled, but there are other things that are really...
Different uptightness.
Really Christian still here, I think, rather than in France a bit more liberated, more accepting.
A bit dirtier.
Oh, Paris was so dirty.
I want to ask you about finding a willing crowd to perform to and what your experience has been with that.
Just get people from the street to come to my show. I'm desperate now. Finding a willing crowd.
Because I sometimes feel like in the same way that I'm happy to make a meal for somebody who's hungry, I'm really happy to make a dance for somebody who's hungry for it. But if people aren't really hungry for the meal, then I don't have the same amount of drive to cook, I guess.
So I think that's one of the differences between Europe and here, maybe. It's here there's not really a demand.
Yeah, right. For
art. They don't see... I see art... For me, every big history change or movement has come with a... With the arts.
An art movement.
Artists, yeah. You know, surrealism, for example, Breton and all this. It came, you know, the war, post-war, all this. There was always a big art current coming with it. And...
So does society stagnate when art stagnates?
Oh, I think so.
Yeah.
Yes, I think the arts is helping us move forward. And it's any type of art. It doesn't, you know... But now I feel like art has become a real business, and it's as much as I understand why it has become like this, because you know society is changing and capitalism, and it's a shame because it's almost like, and with curators and all this, artists are not really doing what they want to do as much. They have to do. You know, there's always the things that you want to do and the things that you have to do because you also have to, you know, pay rent and all these things. So or you have the producer who says this is not going to work. Or, for example, I really would like to just make intimate works. I love just having 30 people to a show because it's not something that you get to do very often. And when you have 800 people in a room, as much as it's great for the box office, you don't relate to them the same way.
Yeah.
And here it's just not viable. If you just say, oh, I just want 30 people in the room, we're just going to go, no, it's not, you know, we're not going to make any money at the box office. Forget about it. Mm-hmm. And
performance?
No.
I imagine not.
But that's also one of the things. Like, when I was training in France, there was always the theatre runs at lost.
Yes.
And here it's like the theatre has to make money or cut even.
Yeah.
And but the theater it's the wrong philosophy
the
for the arts.
The runs at a loss so that society can run at a gain.
Yeah. And it's also, I mean, tickets price are just so expensive that who can afford to go?
Mm.
You want everyone to come and see a show, not a certain type of people.
And especially when you're making something that people don't yet know that they want, because you're oversupplying, you've got more supply than demand, then it needs to at least be cheaper than the thing that they already know that they want. Like the Martian movie or whatever that is cheaper than a dance show.
But it's also difficult here because often you just have 2 weeks, 3 weeks to make a show.
Yeah, you gotta revolutionize your practice and have epiphanies. And
I mean, in 3 weeks, it's very short. I've always been, again, I'll keep on talking about Europe, but back home it was 2 months.
Yeah.
And then you make a show. But often people have a company and they have a space and they can work all year around towards the, you know, the work. And here it doesn't work like this. And there's a massive pressure on the artist to make something that is perfect the first time. That's what I think. Maybe it's not true, but I think it's impossible. And especially when you're emerging, you know nothing. You haven't lived yet and you're just trying things out. But somehow you're going to be, if you put something on stage, you're going to be looked at as some, we don't care if you're emerging or not. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. And it's sometimes it's just the way that that's framed. Like the new breed season for Sydney Dance Company, a lot of the people that make those shows, that's their first or second piece they've ever made. But because it's being put on at Carriage Works by Sydney Dance Company and it's got the marketing of that production house behind it, you expect it to be the same as when somebody has made 40 works, makes a piece. And I think the reason that you feel like you've got to present your piece perfect the first time you present it is because people will only come once. And so that's your only chance as well.
If you do shit work, they won't come back.
And if you present the piece again with the same name and cast and concept and idea, but you've honed it over time in response to audience response, then people won't come back because they've seen it.
And that's a lesson that I learned actually for Dining Unstable, because I presented it at the old 505 before packed with the same title. And I believe that, you know, every time you present a show again, if it's a year after the first, you know, it evolves. It has to, especially when it's something that is personal and something like this, it has to move forward. And some people just thought it was the same piece where it was a complete...
Like it was a tour.
Yeah, but it was a completely different piece. There was almost nothing.
Do you think it would have worked to just call it...
Something else?
maybe something else or episode two or...
Yeah,
I thought of the finale, or even what's the solution? Some Australian choreographers are now doing series.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they're doing triptychs or something.
Yeah, and I think because it evolves over time. Yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
or they just do the same piece and the same idea, and they call it a different thing, and it gets up again.
Well. Yeah,
which is why I don't go and see the shows of entrenched companies anymore, because then you know that I saw that show. They're like, but it's got a different name. Yeah, but I've seen that show.
I've seen it already. I don't know.
Tell me, what is your biggest hope?
I try not to hope. I think it's a waste of time. I think you better do than hope, because you can hope that something great's going to happen tomorrow and it never happens. But if you give yourself the chances for it to happen, it will.
What are you giving yourself the chance?
Just to keep on making and, you know, and trying and because it makes me happy. It's very selfish, but it's true. I like it. And
it's selfish, but it's also very considerate, because if you don't do the things that make you happy, then you become another disgruntled citizen who puts himself in a victimized situation of
I think a lot of us complain a lot and waste too much time.
Brings people together.
Yeah, but it's wasting time to just complain and whinge about things instead of trying to make things. I mean, I'd say that the Brandis thing was probably one of the best things that could have happened to the arts in
the scare,
or just the fact that he said, I'm going to give all this money to these 20 companies, and then suddenly was like, oh my God, people just came together instead of being against each other. There's a lot of against, I feel, here. Like, it's almost like, oh, this person might present a work, and if they do, I won't present mine. Because, you know, you're in competition. A little bit, there's this idea of competition sometimes that I just don't like. It's just everyone has something to offer, and we're not making the same anyway. So just be happy for everyone to be making what they're making. And, yeah, just seeing the artist kind of getting together and saying, no, this is not right. Because Australia is not a country where people strike, you know. France we strike for everything. And part of me was like, God, I need to teach them how to strike properly, because it's not by doing some dance moves on the street that is going to change anything. We need to sit down, you know, on a Monday morning at 7:30 in the morning, sit down on Parramatta Road when everyone wants to go to work so they can't go to work, and then you annoy people.
Yeah, right.
Take something from from someone, and they get pissed off. If you do that on a Sunday afternoon, and after you walked, a kilometer, you go, oh, let's go and have a beer now. We've protested. It's not a protest anymore.
So a protest needs to be some kind of disruption.
Of course, otherwise it's, it's nothing. That's the French in me. People are going to think I'm mad or so pretentious. Sorry.
But passionate.
But art is about passion. If you don't have any passion, don't make art.
Yeah. Yep. You reckon that's your big statement, your big epiphany?
I think the day you lose the passion, just stop. Do something else.
Let someone else do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you can lose your passion for 2 years and then come back to it, maybe, because you need breaks. It's important as well to take some breaks and...
Yeah.
Even though it's hard sometimes because you feel like you're going to miss out on something. But it just helps you to kind of reboot, a bit like a computer.
Yeah.
And go, okay, what do I really want to do?
Yeah. I sometimes wonder if it's only enjoyable to dance 2-3 days a week, for example, but companies run on office working schedules, which is 5 days a week, 9 till 6. And so their dancers are dancing the amount of time that an office worker would sit at a computer. And then the passion, exactly, gets overdrawn.
I think.
And maybe it would be a far more passionate company if it was 3 days a week. Or if it was double casted.
Yeah, maybe. Or just give them, because then, it becomes a job.
Yeah.
And it becomes about being perfect, getting it perfect. I think you're right. It's
but maybe what we want is not what everybody wants. But imagine if, say, an entrenched full-time dance company had twice as many dancers, but they worked half as many hours. And, okay, their pay drops by half, but then you've got a whole bunch of people who can afford to live and get by and eat and pay rent, who also have time to think and make their own work and reconsider and reposition themselves in relationship to their choreographer or director or whatever, so that better questions get asked in the studio. You don't just have these minions who are completely emotionally and physically exhausted that are just trying to keep up with their output.
And also I think doing other things, even if you're not so good at it, so you can be an amazing contemporary dancer but be very interested in design. And maybe the key is like, maybe you do 4 days a week or 3 days a week of dancing, and then you do a bit of design as well, you know what I mean, which will influence your dance practice ultimately, or you make music if you like music. I feel like a lot of dancers in companies, once they're not in the company anymore, they're very lost maybe, because what else can we do?
What else do you do?
Yeah. I mean, I think every dancer's had that problem anyway. Once you get to a certain age, you just go, oh, I'm a bit old now. I can't kick my leg like this anymore.
What else do you do when you're, like, for what being inspired or engaged or passionate?
What I try to do is also do new things. Like, so I was trained in ballet and contemporary, but now I do more aerial work as well. Not saying that I'm great at it, but...
But you're interested.
I'm interested, and I do a lot of contact improvisation, which I love. And actually, I had a point where I was like, I didn't know what I was dancing anymore.
Yeah.
Did a big project, was like, okay, that was great, I loved it, but I need to reconnect with me, myself. It's weird to say that again. Anyway.
No, but it's a big milestone to think, I don't know why I'm dancing anymore.
And going to contact and just doing these improv for, like, you just danced for 2 hours with, just have fun. And I was like, oh, that's what it is. Dance is fun. And finding the fun in it, just, I reconnect. And I just did this for like 6 months, you know, doing classes, training, just contact. And yeah, I don't know, something happened and I just went, that's why I do it. And then I was able to, you know, go back to more technique class, I guess. But at some point you also had to say, I just want to move, forget about the technique and do other form of movement that are a bit more liberating than just the shape of it.
Well, I think there's just a lot of ways to dance. There's a lot of forums to do that in.
And Australia's really rich with all of these different forms, I think. Yeah, but I think I said everything to say, unless you